Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist specializing in pain and palliative care, and he serves as the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ken Miller welcomes Dr. Mario Schnall. Dr. Schnall is an associate professor of medicine and medical oncology, and he's here to talk about the process of drug development and clinical trials.
Mario, you joined the faculty here at Yale, I guess it's been 3 or 4 years ago, after a very long career in oncology and also even in the pharmaceutical industry. Can you tell us a little bit about your background in medicine?
Thanks, Ken. I started working for the part of the National Cancer Institute that's involved in drug development, and I spent 12 years with them. After that, I went to a small biotech company and directed their development of a very novel agent, and then after that, I returned to Yale. So I've had a long experience with drug development in the government and in industry.
So having been in those in all those different environments, can you give us an overview of the process of drug development? And people often refer to it as bench to bedside.
It's a very long process. It really has to start first with discovery of something that has anti-cancer activity. And there are really two ways to find an agent that has anti-cancer activity. One is to take chemical compounds and basically screen them against cancer cell lines that are growing in test tubes. And then something that actually has activity, you take forward in further development. The more exciting approach over the past 10 years has been the ability to define the mechanisms that drive cancer progression, the exact molecular mechanisms, and then screen chemical agents against those specific targets to see if any of them have anti-cancer activity. The latter approach really allows you to define agents with very specific mechanisms of action, and we think those agents are more likely to work in the clinic than the ones that are discovered empirically. Once you have an agent that has anti-cancer activity, there's a very long process to turn that chemical into a drug that you can give to patients. And then subsequent to that, there's a very long process of clinical testing to actually develop the data that will eventually allow you to say the drug actually works in patients.
Along those lines, you know, if we think about drug development, I've heard it referred to as like a funnel. A bunch of new possibilities come in at the top of the funnel, and at the bottom comes out a small number. But actually, can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, how many drugs are sort of looked at originally to sort of come out with one drug that's a good one?
I'm not sure that I can give you an exact number, but I can tell you that it's many, many drugs leading to very few ultimately approved at the end. We tend to use a number of somewhere around only 10% of drugs that really enter clinical trials in cancer will ultimately make it for approval by the Food and Drug Administration. So many, many drugs fail in the initial processes of clinical testing, either because they're toxic or because they just don't have the right activity.
Patients often ask, why does it take so long for a new treatment to become available?
Well, I think that, first of all, often we just hear that a gene is active in cancer or that a gene drives a cancer. And from just understanding the biology to developing a drug against that target can take a very long time. But it's also very important to remember that just taking a chemical entity and making a drug, in other words, putting it into a vial, making sure that it's safe, being able to manufacture the drug, and then testing it in the clinic can take years and years. For example, it can take a year just to find out the right dose and schedule for a drug. And it can take 3 to 5 years to do the final clinical trial that determines whether a drug works or not in patients. So if you're thinking about the initial discovery of a drug in the test tube to final data in a randomized clinical trial that shows that it works, that could be a process of 7 to 10 years.
Which is a very, very long time. And yet I guess that all those safety nets are in place to assure that it's the best drug for the patient.
Well, absolutely. You don't want to have a drug on the market that doesn't work or has unpredictable toxicity. Even if it has toxicity, you have to understand how to manage that toxicity so you can give it safely. And of course, you want to know ultimately that a drug works. And to know that a drug works can take a very long time. So, but particularly the safety issues, you need a lot of information, and you need to treat a lot of patients to know how to manage a drug well.
Now, what role does the government play in cancer drug development?
The government plays many roles in development. First of all, it funds much of the basic research and much of the clinical research required to take an agent from the bench to the bedside. The government does its own drug development. So not only does it fund it, but it also has a drug development arm. The National Cancer Institute, for example, has a group that's very much like groups that are present in pharmaceutical companies that develop drugs. And finally, the government is involved in the regulation of both clinical research and ultimately drug approval.
There's been a lot of publicity about something called fast track approval. I mean, how does that differ? And that people talk about the FDA having a fast track. What does that mean?
All that really means is that the FDA commits to reviewing an application for approval in a somewhat more compressed time manner. But it doesn't really speed the process of drug development as much as what might be thought of in the community. You still have to do the phase 1 trials. You still have to do the phase 2 trials. You still have to do the phase 3 trials. It's only once you gather all of that information that the fast track process really kicks in.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so all the work still has to be done, but it sounds like then the final review is quicker?
It can be faster, yes.
All right. Can you review with us, because I think it's interesting information about what is phase 1, 2, and 3?
Well, a phase 1 trial, remember that when a drug comes into the clinic, there's no information. We don't know what dose to give. We don't know what schedule to give. So we have to start at a very low dose and escalate the dose slowly. The first dose that you want to give to patients has to be low by definition so that it's safe. And then you escalate the dose in groups of small groups of patients until you find what's called the maximum tolerated dose. That's a phase 1 trial where you actually determine a tolerable dose and schedule. Then the drug goes into phase 2 trials, which is really activity testing. There you want to know whether the drug has activity and basically whether it causes tumors to shrink or you use other measures such as improvement in symptoms. But even then, it's not absolutely clear that activity translates into benefit. And for benefit, you need to do a phase 3 trial, which is usually a randomized trial, either adding the drug to standard therapy or comparing the drug to standard therapy. And it's in those randomized trials where you really determine the two measures of benefit, which for patients are really an improvement in symptoms or an increase in their lifespan.
The other thing that we hear very frequently from patients, I mean, we hear it in the press and I think ourselves too, I mean, new medicines cost so much money, especially some of these new targeted drugs. Why are they so costly?
The process of drug development is just enormously expensive. I'll give you an example. A patient who goes into a phase 3 trial, that final phase of drug testing, it can cost the company up to $50,000 per patient to enroll the patient, collect the data, and pay for all the other necessary tests that need to be done in order to develop the data that ultimately is submitted for registration. So if you think that a clinical trial, a phase 3 clinical trial, just that last stage might be 1,000 patients, you may be looking at, you know, $25 to $50 million investment just at that stage. We estimate that it may cost $75 million to $100 million to get a drug from test tube all the way to registration at the FDA. And you're not only paying for the development of that drug, you're also paying for all the costs of developing the other drugs that failed in the clinic.
Mario, let me just ask, you know, in your career, but I mean, have there been drugs that you've worked with from the bench that have made it all the way to practice or close?
Very few of us have had the the privilege of working from a drug just from the test tube all the way to registration. I've been involved in the registration process. For example, the drug interleukin-2, I was very involved with the clinical development and the registration of that agent. But I can't say that I've been involved from the very beginning to the very end for any drug, and there are very few people who can claim that.
I was about to say, it also sounds like it's a very, very long process. It would be most of someone's career. Many people hear about medical breakthroughs on the news, and then they go to their doctor and they bring an article with them, and then the doctor says that that therapy is not available yet. Any advice for patients who are in that situation? If they go to their community doctor and they're not able to get the drug on the market,
well,
are clinical trials useful in that? To participate in that situation,
it really depends on what the breakthrough is. If the breakthrough is that the drug cures cancer in a mouse, I can assure you that would be many, many years before that drug would be available to patients. If the drug is already in the clinic, they may be able to access it through a clinical trial. And sometimes, for example, if the information comes from a late stage clinical trial, then that drug might actually be available through compassionate use programs that are usually set up at major cancer centers. So again, it depends. But the best thing to do would be to check with an expert in the disease and to see if that drug is currently available for treatment of patients.
Let me ask you about, you mentioned compassionate use. What does that mean?
Well, many times, as you know, when a drug is being developed, data is generated that shows that it actually works, or at least very strong suggestion that the drug works. But it takes time, even from that information, to final registration approval and marketing by the FDA. So the FDA has a process in which drug companies can provide the drug through a clinical trials mechanism, essentially to patients who would not be able to get the drug otherwise. So it looks like a clinical trial, but in fact, it's a treatment protocol.
So it's in a sense, trying to make the drug available a little bit quicker for people that have problems.
That's exactly right. It's being made available for treatment as though the drug works, but it's not commercially available. So it's being made available through a compassionate use clinical trials process. And under those circumstances, the eligibility criteria are much looser. So many more patients can get access to the drug than might be able to get the drug in a clinical trial.
Are those drugs provided free of charge in that setting, or is there...
Almost always they're provided free of charge.
Yeah. There are different settings, and you've talked about it a little bit already, about where drug development is taking place. There's the federal government, there's pharmaceutical companies, academic medical centers. What are some of the differences in the drug development process in those settings?
Well, the government and industry develop drugs in a very similar way. Academic centers don't actually do drug development. They participate in drug development. Drug development is really the entire process of taking a molecule from the very beginning to the very end, whereas academic centers are involved in drug discovery and they're involved in individual clinical trials. But they usually don't take or are not involved with the entire process from beginning to end.
Yeah, it sounds like that portion of it is really almost a Herculean effort with many different people involved and different laboratories. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. It's a huge effort, and the collaborations between industry and academics are very strong, and they need each other in order to develop drugs successfully. It's very important to have drug companies involved in this process because they're the ones who oversee, they're actually invested in the success of that drug. And after all, if they weren't involved, who would be available to manufacture, produce the drug, put it in a vial, and make it available in the marketplace so that patients have access? So they're very important in the process.
Well, we'd like to remind you that you can email your questions to us at canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about drug development with Dr. Mario Schnall from the Yale Cancer Center.
Breast cancer is the second most common cancer in women. About 3,000 women in Connecticut will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and new therapies are providing more options for breast cancer patients, and more women are able to live with breast cancer than ever before. Beginning at age 40, every woman should schedule an annual mammogram, and you should start even sooner if you have a risk factor associated with breast cancer. Screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle are the most important factors in defeating breast cancer. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to make new treatments not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration available to patients. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here today with Dr. Mario Schnall from the Yale Cancer Center discussing clinical trials and drug development. Mario, we've been talking a little bit about clinical trials. Well, you know, why are they important to patients, and why are they important to medicine in general?
Well, first of all, without clinical trials, we wouldn't make any advances in clinical medicine. And in cancer, the truth is, we do okay, but for the most part, most of our treatments in advanced cancer aren't very effective. So we need clinical trials in order to find better treatments for patients. And for an individual patient, often the standard treatments are not optimal. They may get some benefit from it, but they may not be cured. So a clinical trial may offer them a chance to have even a better outcome in that setting.
All right. Can you give us an example? I mean, you're very active in clinical trials here at Yale. Well, you know, from the work that you're doing, what's an example of a clinical trial that you're excited about here?
Well, we, as an example, we're going to be bringing a drug into clinical trials. We didn't discover it, but we're going to be collaborating with a pharmaceutical company on an agent that works specifically in the tumor microenvironment to block the tumor's defenses against immune responses. So essentially, it'll help enhance the immune response to attack and kill tumors. Now, that drug is in early clinical testing, so this will be a phase one trial in which we'll look at escalating doses and prolonged treatment schedules. And in that clinical study, we'll study the immune responses of patients and we'll observe for anti-tumor responses. But we're very excited about this drug because both from a biological perspective and both the animal model data, it's a very active agent.
Now, you know, it sounds like, by the way, like a fascinating trial to be able to look at how the immune system might help defend against cancer. It actually brings up the whole topic what I would call sort of look at as modern approaches to clinical trials. How does your approach now differ than what it would have been 15 years ago?
There's a great deal more emphasis today on trying to, because we now understand the mechanisms of these drugs, or at least have a better understanding of the mechanisms of these drugs. There's a great deal more emphasis in early clinical studies and actually in lay clinical studies to obtain blood and tissue from patients and to really verify that whatever effects we were seeing in the test tube and in animal models actually occurs in patients. If we do this early in the clinical development process, we know that at least, we don't know for sure that the drug works, but we know that the drug at least has the right biological activity, and it gives us encouragement to proceed and do the larger phase two and phase three clinical trials. Sometimes if a drug doesn't work and we do these biological studies, we understand why the drug doesn't work, and then we could go back to the lab and develop better drugs for patients.
So you're saying, in a sense, if you know what a target is, you know what you're going after, but if you find very early on that this drug doesn't really hit the target, it sounds like you might be able to build a better drug?
Absolutely. Sometimes it doesn't hit the target for simple reasons. Maybe you don't get the right blood levels, or we find out that it's metabolized incorrectly, or sometimes we find out that maybe that target isn't as important in humans as we thought it might be. There's another, by the way, very interesting use for markers, which is to select the patients that might respond. Remember, even for a single disease, breast cancer, lung cancer, melanoma, even if you have melanoma, it's still a very heterogeneous disease. Every patient has perhaps their own molecular biology, their own biology. So we treat 100 patients with a drug, and we might only see 20% of the patients that benefit. So one of the things we're trying to do when we get blood and tissue is to try and identify those patients that might respond. So we can turn a drug that might be a 20% drug into a drug that's a 60 or 70% response rate drug.
All right. So in other words, you're not I'll phrase it a different way. You're finding the group of patients who are most likely to benefit.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
So for example, in melanoma, we could talk about other types of cancer too, but what kind of target might you look for that would say to you, geez, this is a patient who's really going to benefit from my therapy?
Well, Ken, I think we're going to talk about a disease rather than melanoma where we don't yet have those markers. We can talk about a disease that you're very familiar with, which is breast cancer. And a good example is Herceptin in breast cancer, where we identify the patients who might respond to Herceptin by identifying a specific molecule on the surface of the breast cancer cell, which Herceptin identifies. So we only treat those patients that have expression of that receptor.
All right, I want to go back a little bit to this, the issue of clinical trials, because it's such a great thing for us to learn about. What is a randomized clinical trial? I mean, sometimes, and why are they important? I mean, sometimes people say, you know, I don't want to be randomized. I want the doctor to tell me which treatment I should have.
The reason we do randomized trials is that we really don't know that the new treatment, whether we're comparing standard treatment to new treatment or adding the new treatment to standard treatment, whether it actually helps. I mean, we have some idea that it may be useful from a phase 2 trial, but a phase 2 trial only tells us that the drug is active. It doesn't tell us that it prolongs life, for example. So in order to know that, we have to randomize patients in an unbiased way to receive standard therapy versus a new therapy. And that, in a very rigorous scientific way, really tells us that the drug works. Otherwise, we don't know. We're guessing. And many times when we've thought, based on non-randomized studies, that a drug is beneficial for patients, when we take that drug to a randomized trial, we find that it's no better than standard treatment.
Now, if a patient's participating in a randomized trial, and the information, is someone overlooking the trial to see if one arm is not as good and or if one arm is clearly better?
Absolutely. Randomized trials have, by definition, what's called the Data and Safety Monitoring Board. And those people look at the data intermittently to make sure not only that the new drug is well tolerated, but also to make sure that the activity is what it should be. In other words, if early on in the trial it turns out that the experimental arm is no better than the standard arm, they'll stop the trial early. On the other hand, if it turns out that the experimental arm is much, much better than the standard treatment, they'll also stop the trial early and then offer the experimental treatment to the patients who are receiving the standard treatment.
All right. So I think for a patient who's thinking about participating in a trial, they do have a sense that someone's overlooking.
No question about it. This is a very tightly regulated process to ensure both the safety of the patients and to make sure that they're getting the best treatment.
Mario, how should a patient decide if he or she should become involved in a clinical trial?
I think that's a very difficult question, and I think they need to have a very long discussion with their physician about all of the options, both standard treatments and investigational treatments. And if their physician is not terribly familiar with clinical trials for that specific disease indication, it's then worthwhile to get a second opinion with an expert in that disease who really does understand all the clinical trial options for that disease.
And for the patient, they would be, again, to try. What's the process of informed consent? What does that mean, and how does that translate to actually the day-to-day practice?
Well, we've developed over a very long period of time a process in which patients are informed completely of the risks and benefits and their rights within a clinical trial. And it's all incorporated into often very long documents that we provide to patients to read so that they know exactly what they're going to get, what kind of drug they're going to get, when they're supposed to be in the clinic, how much blood is going to be drawn, what the risks of the trial are, and their rights to, for example, to withdraw from the study at any time. The informed consent also informs them of all the confidentiality protections that are now in place for patients. And it gives them phone numbers to contact both for the physicians and also for the ethics review board at the institution, where they can ask questions or make complaints if necessary.
So it sounds like it's a pretty thorough document.
A very thorough document, and in fact, one of the things that we're concerned about is that there's so much information that sometimes it's hard for patients to go through it all.
Do you get a sense in the United States what percentage of people with cancer are being treated on a protocol?
Unfortunately, it's a very low number. It's probably less than 10%, and some people have estimated as low as 2 or 3% of all patients, really, with cancer go on clinical trials. And that's a shame, because clinical trials is often the best option for most patients, and it's the only way we're going to advance the field.
I wanted to ask you a little bit, you know, in terms of informed consent, there's a lot of discussion about risks and benefits. So what are some of the risks associated with a clinical trial?
Well, I think the major risk is that you're getting an investigational agent, and therefore the full side effect profile isn't known. So even though there's information from animal models and from patients who've received the drug before, there are always unexpected side effects that may occur. I think that's really the major risk.
And the benefits on the other side would be what?
Well, the benefits are unknown. That's why we're doing the clinical trial. We have an idea of what the benefits might be, but the fact that it's a clinical trial means we really don't understand the benefits. And in fact, for many clinical trials, there may be no benefit at all.
What are some of the clinical research you're involved with now that you're excited about?
In general, there are early phase clinical trials, so very novel drugs that are being tested in phase one studies. And those are very good options for patients in which all standard options have been exhausted. There are also phase two trials in which we know something about the drug. And the drugs range from drugs that target blood vessels to drugs that activate the immune system to very novel drugs that block signaling pathways in cancer cells. Just a wide variety of mechanisms of action and very interesting new agents.
Can you give us an example in any part of the cancer center you like? It could be in your own field, melanoma, or a different field, but of one trial that again, you're particularly excited about.
Well, I'll give you an example of two trials. One is at the other, one end of the range, which is a compassionate use study of a new immune therapy called anti-CTLA-4. And this is a very powerful activator of the immune system, so powerful that it can actually sometimes cause side effects of turning the body's immune systems against their own tissues. But we and others have seen some incredible responses. It's unfortunately only in a small number of patients, but incredible responses in patients who would otherwise have been refractory to all other kinds of treatment. So we're very excited about this agent, but in fact, it's in very late-stage clinical testing. And at the other end of the spectrum, we're testing a very novel immunotoxin, which is essentially an antibody that binds to the surface of tumor cells. And attached to this antibody is a toxin. It's like a Trojan horse. It enters inside specifically only into melanoma cells. And once it's inside the cells, it releases the toxin and kills the melanoma cell from the inside. And that's an early stage clinical trial, but we're also very excited about this kind of an agent.
I have to say, it sounds, on one hand, it sounds like Star Wars. On the other hand, it sounds like it's really, these things are being done and really may make a big difference for our patients.
Well, we certainly have to prove that, but yes.
Good. Mario, I want to thank you. This has been a terrific program. It's really, I think, given us, myself, also a very much improved understanding of what happens in drug development. I want to thank you very much for joining us on Yale Cancer Center Answers.
Thanks for having me, Ken. Appreciate it.
And from all of us here on the program, we'd like to, and from
if you
Yale
have
Cancer Center, we want
comments,
to wish you
or would
a
like
safe
to subscribe to our
week.
Podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, you'll learn about the surgical treatment of esophageal cancer.